Welcome to Episode 1 of RISE, an Eastern Standard series about present realities and future prospects for Eastern Kentucky in the aftermath of the most powerful and devastating flash flood ever to sweep over a region of the Commonwealth long familiar with flooding. Decades of logging and coal mining have stripped surface areas of their ability to absorb water when it rains. What happened across a 13-county swath of eastern Kentucky in the early morning hours of July 28, 2022, has left many at a loss for words. But words are a way of life for Mandy Scheffel, owner of the Red Spotted Newt bookstore in downtown Hazard.
You had entire hollers that were just leveled out because the creek that flooded may, on a good day, be, 4 to 6 inches, where after this rainfall event, the entire holler was underwater.
As extreme weather seems to become more frequent, how will efforts to prevent future losses of life and property affect a mountain culture characterized by deep, strong ties to place, family, and neighbors? Will enough people remain in the region to keep local tax bases above water with the resources they need to respond when crisis strikes? These are just some of the many questions raised in conversations and interviews we've recorded for this series. And now we want to share with you those questions and some of the answers. RISE is produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. To learn more about this series and our team and to listen to full-length interviews, visit weku-rise.org. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening. In the days, weeks, and months since the July flood, people from all around Kentucky and other states in the region have stepped up and volunteered to help wherever needed. Among them, Mike Harrison, pastor at First Christian Church in Pikeville and a member of the Pike County Long-Term Recovery Group.
We anticipate at least 2 to 3 years just to get these people back to some sense of normalcy. So while the news story's gone, the real story hasn't ended.
The real story has continued to unfold at community listening sessions hosted by the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky in Breathitt, Knott, Letcher, and Perry counties, gatherings where the flood of 22 was described in detail by those who experienced it. Chris Begley was on hand for the Whitesburg meeting.
Randy Wilson stepped up to the microphone at a community meeting about long-term flood relief in Letcher County recently. He introduced himself, then talked about the banjo he was going to play. It was made from a fruitcake tin with a design he liked and the black walnut fretboard made by a friend from a tree that had grown not far away. Randy sang and told stories. He recounted the late-night phone call that alerted him to the flood happening back home. He was out of town. And the neighbors trying to rescue his car from the rising water. He told about coming home, discovering the extent of the damage to the house, and dealing with that and the pile of debris out front. He conjured improbable images from the flood, wading the streets of Hindman, picking up dulcimers that floated away from the luthier, and the drunken Samaritans that showed up, cooked food, and then just disappeared. These stories began the process of mythologizing the event. The evocative turns of phrase and unlikely juxtaposition fixed the flood in our narrative memory as profound and unprecedented, but also decidedly Appalachian. The story anchored the flood in tradition, even the nonsensical imagery. In the hands of a storyteller, the raw bones of the event were gathered up and transformed into a mountain yarn. The familiar style and cadence of the song and storytelling felt comfortable. Then the story took a dark turn. It was not a surprising turn, and we half expected it, but we also half hoped to escape it. Randy told us about his friend who went out in his kayak to look, to check it out, to understand what had happened. Maybe it was something in his voice as he said this, or maybe because we all knew what one might find, and that the toll was much higher than destroyed houses. The story changed with those words. The next sentence was worse. I came across a 10-year-old girl, the friend said. It was hard to listen to this, up to now, our storytelling expectations, the absurdity and the humor, hid the jagged little edges of the lived experience. We knew the hard truths, of course, but to hear it in this familiar form was rough. The creek's not safe, we know. Nor is the house, and now neither are the stories, not anymore. Was she alive, Randy asked in his story. We all knew the answer. Hell no. That was a hard way to answer that question. Those two words said a lot more than no. In those words, I heard, you knew that. And why did you make me say it? And let's not talk about it. And that was the end of the story. Some of us sitting there only imagined scenes like this, but others remembered them. I was reporting on the meeting and taking photos. I wanted to see how people reacted, but I didn't want to look at them or have them look at me. I looked through my camera lens where they couldn't look back. Stories are powerful. As journalists, we report news. We also share stories that help us understand in ways that facts and figures alone cannot. We need to hear them.
Eastern Standard Special Topics reporter Chris Begley. In the final week of July 2022, Dustin Jordan at the National Weather Service station in Jackson, Kentucky, was seeing trouble brewing.
We'd already had a lot of rain leading into the event, so we were already kind of primed for the potential for flash flooding.
Not only did steady rain continue, by the night of July 27th and into the morning of the 28th, it was coming down in torrents, nonstop. This was not a typical rainstorm for eastern Kentucky, a place where floods and flash floods have long been a part of life, with many communities situated along streams, creeks, and rivers in narrow valleys between steep mountains, hollers, that define and distinguish the topography of southeast Kentucky. This rainstorm was different. Lexington Herald Leader reporter Bill Estep.
I've been reporting on eastern Kentucky off and on for more than 35 years, so I've covered a good amount of flooding out there. It's not unusual, but this flooding was off the charts in terms of what I've seen there before. It was a scale that I hadn't seen before. And then people in the region say the same thing. People who lived there 80, 90 years that I've talked to said they had never seen flooding in some of the places that flooded in late July.
About 6 a.m. that morning, we realized that the water was getting higher and higher.
Tracy Goff from the Quicksand area of Breathitt County, situated along the North Fork of the Kentucky River, sharing with Jackson reporter Crystal Jones her account of what happened to her home.
It had flooded in the area before, but in our particular house, it had only ever got up in the basement, and that was supposed to have been a once-in-a-lifetime flood the year before. So I had no idea that it would ever get up, you know, that high again, especially not to get into our house.
Crystal also sat down with Laura Thomas, mayor of Jackson, also located along the North Fork of the Kentucky River.
I've had so many people say that, they either didn't leave, they didn't evacuate, they didn't move things because it had never been, so high before.
In the Knott County community of Emelina, Kathy Jones told me,
it was high enough on the level in the garage that it was going into the electrical outlets.
In Crafts Colley, a Letcher County community, Dee Davis and Mimi Pickering, working on East Kentucky Flood, a documentary produced by the Center for Rural Strategies, listened as nonprofit housing developer Seth Long described those early morning hours.
Hearing and seeing the water was just beyond our comprehension. Couldn't get over it, couldn't believe how much water was coming out of these hills so fast.
The Daily Yonder's Anya Slepian found John North at an encampment of trailers provided by the state and set up next to Shelby Valley High School in Pikeville.
Now, water comes from different directions, north and south, both all at once. I've never even thought I'd ever be in such a situation.
We'll be trying to get our heads around this for a long time. It's really disturbing.
University of Kentucky epidemiologist Bev May had watched Wilson Creek come for her Floyd County home. Steady rain had been falling for days on soil that had been hardened by drought. It was the leading edge of the pounding storm that had earlier washed over St. Louis, claiming two there and messing with the lives of thousands. By early morning, July 28th, the off-the-charts intensity of the downpour was triggering massive flash flooding and mudslides unlike anything in eastern Kentucky memory. And as Jackson Mayor Laura Thomas will tell you,
the water just kept coming up.
The rain was pouring down on the steep mountains of southeastern Kentucky, filling hollers with rising, rushing, muddy, contaminated water. Creeks rose rapidly, all that water rushing into homes, lifting them from foundations and carrying them away. Around midnight in Whitesburg, the North Fork of the Kentucky River began rising, and 10 hours later, the river was 11 feet above flood stage. That's about 9 feet above the level that floods riverside homes.
That heavy rain, especially like Whitesburg, they broke their record. You know, this is a record that was established in the 50s.
Pete Gregorian, a meteorologist at the National Weather Service station in Jackson. The station had issued a 6-county flash flood emergency, a rarely used level of warning, defined for us by Assistant State Climatologist Megan Sharkorodsky.
A very rare and extreme situation where you're having extremely heavy rain falling and there is going to be an immediate threat to life and property and essentially catastrophic damage that can occur from that.
This time it came in the middle of the night.
Hazard bookstore owner Mandy Scheffel.
There was little warning, especially for people in remote areas where there is no cell phone service. You know, they had no warning. They had no way of knowing what was about to happen.
The heavy, steady rainfall loosened already fragile earth, and in the days following the flood, Dr. Matt Crawford led a field team from the Kentucky Geological Survey to document landslides.
We documented over 1,000 landslides with just the July flood event. Landslides that we think were triggered by that rainfall event, you know, that four-day event. And so we're going to be doing, we got a report out coming out about that. You know, that's everything from quite small slips along the roadway that may be like, you know, like 15 feet long to quite large debris flows that are, you know, 800 feet long.
Scott McReynolds heads the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard.
When the floods first hit, my initial realization was that what we normally do, we weren't going to be able to do. I mean, we didn't have power, we didn't have roads in a lot of places, and there was, you know, bridges were out and all of that. So initially it was, oh, we weren't going to be able to do our normal mission of building and repairing houses. And then right behind that was the realization that the community needed us to use our skills, our staff, our experience, our vehicles, our equipment, and all of that, not to build and repair houses, but to actually to do some hands-on relief. And so we started a couple of days, well, I think the day of the flood, actually getting out, delivering some water in some of our trucks, one truck, and then it just kind of grew, and we were doing demolition of some structures that were blocking bridges within a day or two. We found out about 3 days in that the group we thought that was going to organize the volunteers doing some of the initial muck outs wasn't really going to work out. And so we jumped in and led that relief effort. And so for the first couple of weeks months, it was really just kind of focusing on the muck outs and that emergency relief. And then at some point, we begin to think about, you know, repairing and rebuilding.
In all, 13 southeastern Kentucky counties were declared federal disaster areas. Breathitt, Clay, Floyd, Johnson, Knott, Leslie, Letcher, McGoffin, Martin, Owsley, Perry, Pike, and Whitley.
It's been devastating. It's been the worst thing that's ever happened here. It's been the worst natural disaster ever in eastern Kentucky. I mean, the worst flood in at least 600 years since people have been keeping records. And we are reeling.
Former State Representative Angie Hatton in conversation at the Pine Mountain Grill and Gifts with reporter Corinne Boyer. 44 people in six counties had lost their lives in the early morning hours of July 28th or in the days that followed.
We all still meet on the street or coffee shop or in the gas station and end up reliving it and crying about, you know, what we went through that morning. But then the idea that we had to clean it up and rehouse everyone and then try to get their basic necessities to them overwhelmed us for weeks.
Many lost their homes. Estimates still vary, but at minimum, 2,000 homes vanished or were severely damaged. More than 100 bridges were damaged or destroyed, cutting off ways to escape or to return. People lost their vehicles, their important paperwork, deeds, birth certificates, their clothes, everything.
Before we even got to the house, you could see, like, hampers of our clothes and, like, items of ours down the road, like, miles down the road against people's fences, so we knew that that would be a problem, that we had lost a lot, just that had floated away.
The belongings of April Brewer's family in Quicksand, among the half-million-ton tangles of debris, logs, rock, and silt that would have to be gathered and hauled away. And later in the series, we'll get into how and why that became an added burden. Some suffered alone, as we hear in Chris Begley's conversation with the Mountain Association's Jimmy Owsley. He also serves with the Floyd County Long-Term Recovery Group.
There was a woman that I visited on, she was at Lower Burton, which is on Left Beaver. And she had been on oxygen. She was in a wheelchair. And so this is nearly 1 week after the flood. She still had no oxygen. She had tried to muck out and clean out her place. She's elderly and like I said, disabled. And a tank of diesel had come downstream. I don't know if it was from a gas station up the road or what, but it had absolutely just put that diesel all throughout her house, and she couldn't get it clean. She couldn't sleep because of the fumes. I smelled those fumes. She couldn't sleep in the house or be in the house for long periods of time. She actually had burns on her feet.
And this is somebody with respiratory issues.
Yes.
Trying to clean out their own diesel-soaked house.
Yes, and needing oxygen and needing medical attention. And we were able to get her help, but I just couldn't believe that was a week after.
The months since the flood have seen a lot of confusion and heartache. Corinne Boyer has the story of Bobby McIntosh.
Rain falls in Jackson, Kentucky on a cold November morning. Bobby McIntosh opens the door to her home.
We had to take the floor before I could get the door open. Just don't walk where it's orange there.
Okay.
Because it's kind of weak.
Neon orange spray paint marks floorboards that can no longer support weight. Small curtains hang over the window of a side door. Their retro orange and green patterns stand out against the walls, stripped to the boards. A dehumidifier sits on the floor working overtime. There's nothing else left inside her home.
Over 80-some years ago, my mom and daddy built it. Years ago, way before I was born. Because he got killed before I was born. He was a state police. And that's why it's important to get it fixed back for nothing but that, you know. But, you know, I need a home, too.
Yeah.
McIntosh doesn't live here anymore. She grew up in this house with her two sisters and a brother. She's proud of her home. She points out red and green letters on lumber cut from a sawmill that form her floors and walls. The house sits up and back about 20 to 25 feet from the creek. Before July 28th, 2022, it had never flooded.
So how high up did the water get in here?
Here, about 6 foot.
In here?
Yes, ma'am. We couldn't stand here.
McIntosh is one of about 2,132 people whose homes were damaged or destroyed in Breathitt, Knott, Perry, and Letcher counties by the 2022 flood. Those four counties were the hardest hit. More than 5 months after the flood, she's one of several people who continue to wait for federal help. Others who lost their homes continue to live in damaged homes, some without utilities or heat. Others live in travel trailers, state parks, and a few still live in tents. McIntosh filed a claim with FEMA. She says she received about $20-some thousand, but has appealed. Because even the maximum award, about $37,000, won't be enough to rebuild her house.
Because, I mean, the prices are so high now. Everything is so high. I don't understand why $37,900. That's not even going to do one room.
One option for rebuilding her home began by having conversations with the Housing Development Alliance. The Hazard-based nonprofit builds and repairs homes in Perry, Breathitt, Knott, and Leslie counties. Here's Mindy Miller with the Housing Development Alliance.
So right now we have 8 homes in construction for flood survivors. We have completed 9 home rehabs, and a home rehab is when you have 2 or more major repairs at one home. So that's usually like roof replacement, floors, bathroom modification, all that sort of thing.
Miller says about 154 families are in the pipeline for repairs, and about 30 families have contacted the nonprofit needing new homes built. The flood was both powerful and unusual, reaching places that had never flooded. Water overtook homes that were not in Federal Emergency Management Agency or FEMA designated floodplains. Housing Development Alliance cannot rebuild homes in floodplains. This is where McIntosh's story gets complicated. She says she spoke with 2 different FEMA workers.
FEMA told me it wasn't in the floodplain and gave me a map.
Learning this was a relief because it meant she didn't have to buy flood insurance. McIntosh says it's an expense she can't afford. But soon, she learned something different.
The Housing Alliance said that it's my location on it is different than what they thought.
Housing Development Alliance confirmed that McIntosh is in the floodplain. This flood was so unprecedented that it changed how the organization decides where to build. Here's Scott McReynolds with the Housing Development Alliance.
We can't just rely on the floodplain. We have to look at, you know, is this property too close to the creek? We've actually didn't buy a couple of lots that we had intended to buy because we felt like even though they're not in the floodplain, they might flood.
Outdated floodplain maps have caused a major issue for many flood survivors. Former Kentucky State Representative Angie Hatton explains.
But only 12% of the damage that was done was in the floodplain. So FEMA's got to revise those floodplains, for one thing, so that flood insurance is available. But for those who already had the damage and don't have flood insurance, they need to keep appealing until they get the maximum amount they can from FEMA.
For people who want to rebuild but were previously flooded, Hatton says the only option is to elevate the home. She's seen one house built with flood specifications by the Appalachian Service Project.
She needed to be exactly 7'4" higher, as I recall, and that's what they did. They made her foundation with stairs up and vents in the foundation, and it's essentially floodproof if this happens again for her.
As climate change intensifies, homes in Kentucky and West Virginia are more likely to flood than previous FEMA assessments showed. According to reporting by the Ohio Valley Resource, using data from the First Street Foundation, 1 in 2 homes in Breathitt, Floyd, Johnson, Leslie, Letcher, McGoffin, and Martin counties is, quote, at risk for flooding damages. Recently, the Housing Development Alliance offered McIntosh another option.
Yes, they wanted me to relocate, but I don't want to because, I mean, this is where I've lived all my life. And just the one-time flood thing, you know, it may not never happen again, and it may happen just any time. But this is my home, my everything, my soul and everything, sure.
While trying to navigate the system to build back, get a home, or still get their basic needs met, flood survivors also deal with the terrible trauma of that night. In all, 44 people have died. She tries not to get too down about her situation. In December, she participated in the Shriners Drive-By Christmas Parade.
I mean, to me, that was worth it, just hear that little Merry Christmas, because they'd say it back to you. And we had a few little stuffed animals and things like that to give to them, you know. And I hope they enjoyed it.
While McIntosh waits for more news from FEMA, right now she's living next door to her house with a neighbor. Grateful for the roof over her head, she worries about other flood survivors and people still living in tents.
I just want people to know that we still need help.
Yes, ma'am.
And we're deserving people. We're not illiterate or foolish, or we just need help.
For Eastern Standard on WEKU, I'm Corinne Boyer.
So what is a floodplain?
Every stream has a floodplain. It's just a matter of what the regulatory standard that applies to that floodplain when it comes to development, use of the floodplain area, use of the water, and the like.
Kerry Johnson is director of the State Division of Water.
The regulatory standard is the 1% annual chance flood, or it's commonly called the 100-year flood. That's a bit of a misnomer, but basically, when it comes to floodplain mapping, we at the Division of Water work very closely with FEMA in identifying those 1% annual chance floods across the Commonwealth. And what an annual 1% annual chance flood is, it's the flood that has a 1% chance of occurring at any given time throughout the year, basically. So it's a large flood. That is the regulatory standard, but that establishes the flood hazard zones that are depicted on community floodplain maps that are used for flood insurance determinations, floodplain management, and other major development decisions.
And, you know, I'm wondering what we expect from these maps. Do we tend to kind of mistakenly view floodplain maps as predictive? And should we think of them more as a snapshot in time? They tell us about past and present, but they're static, so they're not capable of forecasting the future?
That's well said, and I would very much call the floodplain maps deductive because they are based on historical flooding issues. Mm-hmm. Basically, what we do when we conduct floodplain mapping is an assessment of all the historical data that's available, whether it's USGS, gauge data, other flood events that have been documented, and any other data sources that are available in order to find those pieces of documentation.
State Division of Water Director Kerry Johnson. For many who survive, the future is uncertain. Corinne Boyer heard about that from Mindy Miller of the Housing Development Alliance as they drove along Lower Lost Creek in Perry County.
People that live in Eastern Kentucky are survivors. We've survived so many things. But then when this came and this happened, it was something that was so unexpected. You know, nobody ever thought creek water would get up 30 feet or whatever. But when that happened, that's the first time I saw defeat in a lot of people's faces. You know, this was like, I'm throwing in the white towel, I'm giving up. And people here do not give up. They just don't, they never have. But this broke a lot of people when this happened. You know, because you've got people who were poor before the flood, some of them living in poverty, maybe most of them even living in poverty based on where this hit and who it hit. And they have no way to replace the home they had. So what do? Do you stay and live in a tent or live in a home that's not really a home? It's just a place to stay? Or do you go and take your chances elsewhere?
We share these stories because, as Giselle Palma of the nonprofit recovery group SBP put it one December day in Emelina,
survivors feel like they are the main focus, you know, for the first month or so. But after that, or when another disaster comes along, they get forgotten about.
But the people of Eastern Kentucky are not forgotten. As the public radio station of Eastern Kentucky University, we see it as our mandate to amplify the concerns, the struggles, the thinking, and the solutions offered by the people of our broadcast region as they work out a way forward, a way that they determine to be best for them. For many, the heavy impact of this flood feels like some sort of turning point. Donna Daniels heads the Brushy Fork Institute at Berea College.
I really do also see these floods as a turning point, or at least carrying potential as a turning point for the region. It feels to me like from, you know, and I've been doing this work in Appalachia for about 30 years now, I have a sense of a different kind of collaborative leadership and accountability that's happening. You know, we often hear people talk about the need to bring local voices into leadership processes, and I think that both the scale and the gravity of this particular situation highlights issues that probably have been there in our community for a while, but now are exacerbated by the flood and are getting attention to address. And of course, yes, there are, you know, there are more people who are homeless now. There are more people who are suffering, but I think that we're seeing a new kind of convergence around these issues.
Issues such as preparation, flood mitigation planning, analyzing, reducing, and insuring against risk. Alexa Bayer is an investigative reporter at the Mountain State Spotlight in West Virginia. Soon after the flood, she made calls to local emergency officials in both West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky. I got in touch with her. Do counties in the region have flood mitigation plans?
You know, it's interesting. Basically, everyone does. What the state of Kentucky does is they delegate flood planning. A lot of states do comprehensive flood planning for the whole state. What Kentucky does is delegates it to local municipalities. And then within that, there's something called area development districts, and they are in charge of the planning for each city and town. So there are very intricate, long, like 300 page long plans that are already on the books for these communities. But whether, you know, planning and action go hand in hand is another question.
So who is responsible for implementing these flood mitigation plans?
I think that might be part of the problem, right? Like, flood mitigation takes a ton of resources. And the reality is that a lot of these places just don't have it. A lot of places in Eastern Kentucky can't, you know, implement things like moving all of City Hall with their own money. And I think that gets it at part of the problem. While you can theoretically understand the virtue of the state of Kentucky saying, hey, we're going to let these communities that know their issues best decide what to do, in practice, we're seeing that that's not totally working either.
Mountain State Spotlight investigative reporter Alexa Bayer. The Kentucky River and Big Sandy area development districts do have extensive flood mitigation plans available on their websites. Rise on WEKU will continue in a moment with background on who owns the high ground in Eastern Kentucky and climate change. What do we know? What do we need to know?
A lot of things that may have worked, you know, a couple of years ago, it's not the case anymore.
We'll be back in a moment. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Rise, an Eastern Standard special series on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
Rise is a special six-week series airing weekly on Eastern Standard. Learn about what happened when record-setting flash floods hit southeastern Kentucky at the end of July. Explore what contributed to the disaster, how communities are responding, and what's needed to address the challenges ahead. Hear from those most affected and those working on solutions. WEKU's Tom Martin and a team of reporters take us on a journey as Eastern Kentucky navigates a future made less certain by climate change. To learn more about the series and listen to each episode on demand, visit weku-rise.org. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
You're listening to Rise, an Eastern Standard special series about the flash flood that hit 13 counties in southeastern Kentucky in the early morning hours of July 28, 2022, claiming the lives of 44 people.
The problem that a lot of Eastern Kentuckians face with flooding is, you know, the terrain is beautiful around here, but it's expensive to build in a hillside.
Pete Gagarin, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service station in Jackson. He's pinpointing a reason why people living in some of the most impoverished communities in America, areas where many have few options to move to higher, safer ground and can't afford flood insurance, are so vulnerable to flooding.
It's a really interesting question of how these companies came to own this high ground.
Joe Childers is a Pikeville native, former Kentucky coordinator of the Appalachian Land Ownership Study, and currently a Lexington attorney.
It really begins back in the late 1800s when some tycoons related to John D. Rockefeller actually came into the area with the assistance of this Paintsville school teacher who was born in Pike County named John C.C. Mayo. Mayo was well-educated. He had gone to Millersburg to college. He came and he heard some geology lectures while he was in college. He came back, and during those lectures, he learned that there were vast mineral deposits, coal deposits, and other minerals in East Kentucky near where he grew up. So that got him to thinking that he would like to secure some of these rights because he knew that in the future they might be mined. And he began a campaign in around 1880 where he got options on hundreds of thousands of acres of mineral rights and land in East Kentucky. And then he was able to interest some of the oil tycoons, John D. Rockefeller. There was a senator from Kentucky, Senator Camden, who was also involved in Rockefeller's exploits, and he later became one of the founding members of Kentucky River Coal Corporation, which became Kentucky River Properties. So Mayo was the common denominator for land acquisition, mineral acquisition in the Big Sandy Valley and in the Kentucky River Valley. And as a result of that, came to get these options and then ultimately was able to purchase these mineral rights and surface land, which became hundreds of thousands of acres now owned by these large companies. Another interesting side note is that Warren Delano III, who was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's uncle, was very involved in acquiring mineral properties in eastern Kentucky as well. He had done that in Maryland and West Virginia and also was tied in with the John D. Rockefeller folks. And he ended up buying tens of thousands of acres in Harlan County and also in Pike County. And FDR actually was in Harlan County himself with his uncle and was engaged in that mineral buying in the early 1900s.
I know you served as the Kentucky State Coordinator for the Appalachian Land Ownership Study, which was completed back in 1981. Tell us about the findings, and this was 41 years ago, so has much changed in the way of ownership?
The only thing that's changed is that these companies that owned the land in 1981 have acquired more land since that time. And if you go on, for example, Kentucky River Properties, a good example, they're based in Lexington. They're the largest landowner in Letcher, Knott, Perry, and Breathitt counties, which was the very core of this deluge that you referenced earlier, this awful flooding that occurred in July of this year. The worst of it, I would say, was in those four counties. And that just happens to be the counties where Kentucky River Properties is the largest landowner. So the land itself, you know, if you think about population in eastern Kentucky, and particularly concentrating on these four counties, between 1950 and 1970, there was a massive population decline. People were moving out, going north, finding jobs in Detroit and Cleveland, Columbus, and other places because the coal jobs had dried up. Mechanization was taking over. Precipitous drop, 37% population decline in that 20-year period. Beginning in 1970, though, between 1970 and 1980, there was a boom in the coal industry. Some of your listeners may remember that the Arab oil embargo was going on at that time. Coal prices shot up 10 times, and everybody who had a bulldozer within four or five states all of a sudden descended on East Kentucky and started strip mining as much as they could. I witnessed it because I was living in Hazard at the time, and I saw it firsthand. But anyway, so there was a population increase between 1970 and 1980 of 26%. And so what happened in these counties during that period of time, Tom, was that there wasn't a place for these people to live. Most of the people that had moved out between 1950 and 1970 had left these homes, which were not in great repair anyway. They were no longer habitable in 1970 when this influx came back. And so a lot of mobile homes were purchased. A lot of mobile homes proliferated in the mountains during this period of time, and they didn't have any place to put them. So oftentimes they would go into the backyard of their relatives' property. You might see one small track along the creek where you'd have two or three trailers and or mobile homes and people living there. And that occurred all over this area. And it was always along the bottom, always along the creeks, because that's where people lived. They didn't live on the high ground because the high ground was owned by these absentee corporations. So when you saw the flooding this year, you saw a lot of those mobile homes get wiped out. And since 1980 to 2020, we've had a decline of about 21% in population. But there was that period, that 10-year period, where a lot of people came back. And then after 1980, mountaintop removal and large-scale strip mining really became the norm. And the jobs for miners just fell off precipitously. And so you started to see an out-migration again. But we saw during the flood that there were still plenty of people living along those rivers and creeks.
Attorney Joe Childers. Kentucky River Properties has declined our invitation to comment. In December, the company did contribute $500,000, split between nonprofit affordable housing developers, Housing Development Alliance, and Homes, Inc. These organizations are leading efforts to rebuild in the four hardest-hit counties, Breathitt, Knott, Letcher, and Perry. In an interview with WEKU's Stan Ingold, Governor Beshear confirmed there's been movement.
We are in active negotiations on pieces of property in every county that was majorly impacted.
Those negotiations are underway, and we're following them closely. On December 20th, Governor Beshear was in the Knott County community of Talcum on Ball's Fork of Troublesome Creek, about 9 miles northeast of Hindman, announcing the donation by Sean and Tammy Adams of high ground land to be used as a relocation site. The Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky's Jerry Roll was there. I caught up with her as she drove back to her office in Hazard.
Mr. and Mrs. Adams actually donated 75 acres of land that there's a vision where we will be able to build homes, to build neighborhoods, including, you know, some amenities like community centers, possibly a school. You know, we lost four of our schools we have to rebuild. So this is a real opportunity, not only because of the houses, which we desperately need, but if this gives even a handful of people in our region some hope that there is better time ahead, that there is an opportunity coming, then that gives me joy.
Jerry Roll, Executive Director of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and Hazard. But there's always something. You might recall that recent deep freeze that sent nighttime temperatures plunging below zero.
You've also got a lot of water meters that have had the bottoms blown out of them by the freeze, by ice.
Reporter Sam Adams with the Mountain Eagle in Whitesburg. Yeah, tell us about that. I know you just done a story on a problem with water meters, a shortage of them, and I guess that's why, right?
Well, that's partly why, but it's also just a supply chain issue. The Letcher County Water District says there's a 42-week back order for the meters that it uses, and it's going to cost a lot of money to change them out.
And do you see that as a potential problem for new homes that might be built for people who've lost theirs?
Oh, it's more than just a potential problem. It's a current problem. Homes, Inc. is building houses here now for flood victims, and the flood victims can't move in because they don't have any water.
Now, the 900-pound gorilla. It came up in a conversation with reporter Sam Adams. As you're out doing your reporting and talking with people, do people see a connection between flooding and climate change?
Mostly not. There are some who do, but a lot of people here have been so closely tied to coal mining and the coal industry, and they've bought into the mythical war on coal that they really don't see climate change as a problem.
We are seeing climate changing.
Kentucky State climatologist Jerry Brodsky.
We're seeing significant increases in the greenhouse gas levels in the upper atmosphere. And with that increase, we've detected some warming and wetting of Earth's climate, and particularly over the last several decades. And I think a lot of the debate really centers on the degree that anthropogenic forcing is responsible for the climate changes we're seeing.
Meaning people-driven, correct?
Right, people-driven. And because of burning of fossil fuels. And then the question of, well, what's the best way to address this issue politically? And those are very complex issues.
Chris Martin is a professor of forest hydrology and watershed management at the University of Kentucky.
This is a great year to have this discussion. We've had extreme fires out west. We've had extreme drought out west. We've had catastrophic flooding in eastern Kentucky. We've had a series of tornadoes in western Kentucky. We just had an unprecedented flooding event associated with Hurricane Ian in Florida. And it's, you know, the same story in other places like Australia and Europe. And more and more, you know, we're just having these irregular climate events. And, you know, climate is a cyclical thing, but we're experiencing these type of patterns more often. We've noted, along with our, you know, the Kentucky Mesonet, that the last few years have been the wettest years we've had on record. We're seeing some unusual patterns in weather where we have these sort of micro droughts followed by flash flooding, followed by flash droughts. So I think it's not so much of recognizing whether or not climate change is a thing. The climate is certainly changing, and we need to be having discussions and thinking about what are the things that we can do to prepare ourselves for more of these unusual weather patterns and more of these unusual, you know, catastrophic events.
This is where the question becomes really thorny. Is ask yourself what level of risk we as a society are prepared or willing to accept.
State geologist Bill Hanneberg.
Do we want to accept maybe only a 100-year flood and say if something like that happens, it's unlikely enough that we'll accept that risk? Or do we want to start saying, well, no, we need to design mines and even it extends to things like bridges or other infrastructure to maybe handle a 500-year storm or a 1,000-year storm?
For now, and for many, it's a time that puts patience and determination to the test. The word resilience is heard often. Scott McReynolds with the Housing Development Alliance in Hazard.
There are a lot of folks who need housing, and housing is not a quick process, and so that's a real challenge to how you respond. You know, we were fortunate to some of the houses that weren't damaged very much. We've been able to go in and do some minor repairs and get people back in. You know, if a house is completely gone or was heavily damaged, you probably don't want to rebuild there. And so now it's a question of that person needs to find some temporary housing or an intermediate solution while we hopefully can rebuild for them.
That would describe the situation of April Brewer and her family. The Brewers of the Quicksand community in Breathitt County had just begun to recover from the flood of 2021 when it happened all over again last July. Now, as she told Crystal Jones, she and her husband and daughter are guests of friends while they wait for an opportunity.
We're looking to buy a house, which is difficult given the area that we're in because everyone needs to buy a house. But that's really our goal because we don't really want to rent because we feel like we'll waste the money that we were given from like FEMA and the other sources that have helped us. We have stockpiled all of that. All of that is just going to, you know, our new home. And so we don't really want to invest into like an apartment or something, but you know, it's been almost 6 months and it's like, when's the line that we're going to draw to where we have to just rent something or find an apartment? Hopefully that doesn't happen, but you know, we'll see.
Among the dozens we've talked to, there's a strong consensus that housing, is the number one immediate need. They include the Appalachian Citizen Law Center's Mary Cromer.
There is hope that there will be a second round of flood funding from the Kentucky legislature, because they did not address housing at all in the emergency funding that they did, and they sort of left it open with a promise to do something.
At the moment, all eyes are on Frankfort, where the 2023 General Assembly is into its biennial 30-day session that ordinarily would not deal with budgetary matters. The Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky's Jerry Roll.
The legislature is going to have to make sure that there is funding for housing in this upcoming session. I just had a conversation with Representative Blanton, who, as you know, was one of the sponsors of House Bill 1 in the special session that did not include any housing. And we had a very frank discussion about housing. And he said right there at the microphone that he would champion efforts to make sure housing was addressed in this legislative session. So I'm going to hold him to his word, as well as my own Senator Brandon Smith and all of our legislators. Housing cannot wait.
Representative John Blanton.
That's going to come through funding, in my opinion, from the General Assembly. And my push is, I feel like we're going to need about $150 million in the long-term recovery process, and coupled with nonprofit groups to come in to like AHARP and some of those groups and begin building housing for people to move in, to provide access for them. One of the great things about our AHARP, they also provide counseling. You know, many people have rented homes and they've never owned their own home. They don't even know how to care for their home. So provide that type of counseling for them. And we're even talking about building communities with new schools and things along with the housing for these people to move into. So it's a long process. I've had many discussions prior to this session and ongoing with other members of the General Assembly, garnering support for funding for us to begin the long-term recovery of housing there and partnering with these nonprofits so that we can provide adequate housing for them.
In the legislature's other chamber, Senate President Robert Stivers, noting that much of the tornado relief funding already allocated has not been spent, is not sure that additional funding needs to be budgeted.
Right now, like in Western Kentucky, they've only spent 80-some million of the 200. I don't know if we would be opening up a budget or we would just be broadening a use of what's already there.
Another evolving issue that we'll be following as the series continues next week with Episode 2 and a focus on housing. Thanks for joining us. Rise is an Eastern Standard series produced in the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, G. Marie Hibbard, senior producer, Chris Begley, associate producer and special topics reporter, Corinne Boyer, WEKU special projects reporter, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Our contributors from WEKU News, Stan Ingold, Stu Johnson, and Samantha Morrill. Anya Slepian from the Daily Yonder, the Mountain Eagles' Sam Adams, Herald Leader reporter Bill Estep, and Breathitt County reporter Crystal Jones. Thanks to Alexa Bayer of the Mountain State Spotlight. Rise is online at weku-rise.org, and you can contact us from the site. You can find us on the WEKU app, on NPR One, and on the Google News app. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Rise, a series of special editions of Eastern Standard on WEKU.